playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. On Wednesday night, for a moment, we thought, ah, so this is what a Brexit divorce deal looks like.
All right,
guys, I've only time for a few questions before I have to. Who am I kidding? I'll answer questions on Brexit all day long.
Chats.
Taoiseach, what are your thoughts on the draft Brexit agreement?
Well, I think it's fair to say this government has delivered what it promised it would.
We're a bunch of ledgebags, especially this man, Leo the absolute lion.
Stop, Murph.
Someone say the Irish government didn't do anything. It merely suited Brussels to use the Irish border to bash the Brits.
No, that's not true. We played a pivotal role.
Yeah.
Anyone who says all we did was wait for Michel Barnier to email us what to do are totes liars.
But Orty knew about the deal before your cabinet did.
And you're surprised? I mean, have you seen my cabinet?
Yeah, half the Independent Alliance can't even use knives and forks.
But what's important here is we got what we wanted. Mm-hmm. Now that's what's best for Ireland, North and South.
That's not how the DUP are feeling.
Volcano.
Sorry.
It's fine.
Look, I know that many in the DUP and the unionist community might be feeling vulnerable. Many of them are feeling isolated, not to mention bloated, uneducated.
Ignorant, sausage-fingered.
And many of them might be quite worried about their futures, given their lack of good looks and muscle tone.
Lol, they should be, man. Yeah,
we are the party of Michael Collins.
Collins? Sounds a bit travellerish, man.
Quiet, Merce.
Salt.
As regards the North, we believe in the principles of consent.
Yeah.
I mean, our courts are a bit sketchy depending on what type of underwear you're wearing. And that's not cool, guys, by the way.
Hashtag zeitgeist.
But when it comes to the North, mm-hmm. we'll have to wait until the UK is absolutely on its knees.
Yeah.
Probably after Scotland has gained independence and London is trying to move to France. Then, and only then, will the majority of people in Nerny Northern Ireland see sense and we get a united Ireland.
Yeah, but that's a long way off.
Oh, yeah. At least 2, maybe 3 years.
Taoiseach, what do you say to those who think this deal turns Britain into a vassal state?
It's wrong. This deal means Northern Ireland and Britain will have to abide by all the rules and regulations of the EU without having any say in it or any power whatsoever.
Jout.
If it's been good enough for us for the past 40 years. Hello?
From Callan's kicks last night. But then Dominic Raab, Prime Minister Theresa May's main man, her Brexit secretary, lobs a grenade at the draft withdrawal deal the following morning and tweets his resignation. And as the volatility ramped up with more cabinet resignations, speculation went into overdrive that Theresa May herself was as good as a goner. But she's nothing if not tenacious. She put the game face on and defended her Brexit deal in the House of Commons for what seemed like forever.
Mr. Speaker, what we agreed yesterday was not the final deal. It is a draft treaty. It is a draft treaty that means that we will leave the EU in a smooth and orderly way on the 29th of March 2019. I know there are some who have said I should simply rip up the UK's commitment to a backstop, but this would have been an entirely irresponsible course of action. It would have meant reneging on a promise made to the people of Northern Ireland during the referendum campaign and afterwards that under no circumstances would Brexit lead to a return to the borders of the past. And it would have made it impossible to deliver a withdrawal agreement. But a good Brexit, a Brexit which is in the national interest, is possible. We have persevered and have made a decisive breakthrough. Once a final deal is agreed, I will bring it to Parliament and I will ask MPs to consider the national interest and give it their backing. Voting against a deal would take us all back to square one.
There was wall-to-wall comment on Brexit across the airwaves and, of course, on The Gathering with TDs Patrick O'Donovan and Owen O'Brien and journalists Brenda Power and Niamh Lyons.
It's a pity that it is such a good deal because it just has not got a hope in hell of getting through the House of Commons. I think part of the blame for Brexit has always had to go back to the EU. And now you hear the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach quite rightly saying, you know, and admiring Theresa May's recent grit and her determination and her fortitude. And she has really performed admirably recently. But the EU spent the last 2 years breaking her down slowly but surely. I mean, I think it's the same problem as we had when David Cameron first raised the issue as a Brexit referendum, no one has ever given her any comfort from the EU side. So we forced her into a position where we now have a deal that doesn't even suit Remainers. And you had a very interesting discussion earlier, Sean, about the idea of having a second referendum. I think even now, a second referendum wouldn't really even be about that document. It would be about the union, as in the British Union, sticking together. You ask a British person whether or not Northern Ireland should be divided and cracked off from the rest of the UK. No one is going to vote for that.
The hope of people like John McGrain from the British Irish Chamber of Commerce, Brenda Power, was that MPs would come under pressure from their constituents, ultimately business influence and people's concern and cares for their jobs, under pressure to push it through rather than face crashing out.
Niamh, I don't agree with you. I don't think there was a whole lot that the EU could have done in a situation where the objectives of Brexit were never reconcilable with the potential realities. The British people were basically sold the idea. But they were told they could have all the advantages, basically, of EU membership without the bits they didn't like, which, let's face it, boiled down to Johnny Foreigner. That's what it was about. And that was never true. And this business of the 350 million and whatever that was going to come back to the HSE or the NHS was never, ever possible to achieve. And the reality of that was someday eventually going to have to confront them. And that is where we're at now. And I know, you know, you say, yes, maybe push it through in order to avoid the hard Brexit, which is going to be disastrous for everybody. But I think there is, and I know Tony Blair is a busted flush, which is a shame, but he does have a point. There are three options, basically. Vote for this deal, vote for no deal, or let's put the whole thing back on the table. And I think if you had a referendum with those three options, you would split the Brexiteers, and I think it would be overturned.
It's just so hard to see how that can actually be made to happen, because the Prime Minister has set her face against another referendum.
But Sean, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. It was a brilliant, I don't know if you saw, it was a brilliant contribution by, I think it was a backbench MP. He said, you know, recently I asked my maiden aunts would they like to go to the cinema, the three of them. They said they'd love to go next Tuesday. I came back to them and said the options for the cinema next Tuesday are the Texas Chain Saw Massacre or I Spit on Your Grave. But since you've made your democratic decision, which is it to be? I mean, that's where they are. Sean, it's a horror show.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. In a first for Dáil Éireann, TD Ruth Coppinger stood up in the House on Tuesday waving a lacy thong at the cameras, an action which attracted global media attention.
It might seem embarrassing to show a pair of thongs here in this incongruous setting of the Dáil.
Deputy.
But the reason I'm doing it, how do you think a rape victim or a woman feels
at
the incongruous setting of her underwear being shown in a court?
Patient to respond.
And when is this Dáil going to take serious action on the issue of sexual violence?
Ruth Coppinger was only echoing the concern of hundreds of protesters in Dublin, Belfast and in Cork who draped underwear on the steps of the courthouse, calling on the government to stop victim blaming in rape cases.
Stop the stigma, stop the shame. Victims are never to blame. Whatever we wear, wherever we go, yes means yes and no means no.
The protests were sparked by remarks made in a Cork courthouse by a defence barrister in a recent rape trial in which she suggested that the lacy thong the 17-year-old complainant wore was perhaps evidence of consent. Fiona Corcoran spoke to some of the protesters in Cork for Drive Time.
I've experienced sexual violence myself and I have a court case coming up which is going to take which is 3 years almost until I get to do this. And I did everything right. I went to the Gardaí a week later and it's still going to be this long until it's brought to court. And I'm terrified now after hearing this, that they, what are they going to do to me in court if this happens, to this poor 17-year-old girl? Who knows what they're going to bring up against me.
And does it take a lot of courage to go and report it?
Absolutely. I've struggled to do it for ages, and I still wonder, was it enough? But as more time goes by, and with the Robert Gray trial and with this, it's terrifying me, but it's giving me more strength because I'm just like, this is not okay. And this is like, this can't keep on happening. And I'm in the middle of it now, and I know exactly how it feels now. And that's why I'm here today, because I want to stand with that girl who was standing up in court and her underwear was showing her in court, because like, that could happen to me.
When I was 16, unfortunately, I myself was a victim. And I remember going through my head, like, was the jeans I was wearing, they had rips in them? Was I showing too much leg? My underwear was frilly. Was that the problem? Was it because I got drunk? And I'm lucky, I was only assaulted, but I know dozens of people who have been raped violently or otherwise, and they've never gone to the police because they said that they were drunk or that they knew the person or they were wearing the wrong clothes. But I knew if I went to the police, they'd ask me what I was wearing, what I was drinking, who I was with, what evidence I had, as if I was the person who had done the wrong thing. And I knew it would be more traumatic, and not to mention I'd have to sit in court and look at my parents and tell them every person I've been with, everything I've ever done, and justify it all. And honestly, I couldn't, because no one should ever have to.
from Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Wednesday. You know the old argument, quotas diminish women's achievements. But ask any female academic if there is endemic gender inequality in the Irish university system, and the resounding answer is yes, that the glass ceiling needs to be smashed. A new initiative was announced this week by the government where 15 senior academic posts will be created every year for 3 years, 45 posts in all, where only women may apply. Minister for State for Higher Education Mary Mitchell O'Connor outlined the details of this affirmative action to Sean O'Rourke.
Because we've got a lot of texts coming in here, Minister, people asking what is the legal basis for woman-only jobs? It feels like a stunt. It goes against equality legislation, surely, says one of our listeners.
No, it doesn't. And I've taken, listen, I've put a lot of work into this, as has the Attorney General and the officials in the department and the Higher Education Authority. So I'm not pulling this as a stunt. I have authoritative legal advice now from the Attorney General. It's really comprehensive. And this is what's called a positive action because there is inequality in the system. So this positive action that I'm putting in for 3 years, the 15 jobs for 3 years, which amounts to 45 jobs. What this is there, it's strictly constrained and it's confined. And what it will do, it will eliminate actually and reduce actual instances of inequality.
And what will happen at the end of the 3 years? Will the jobs disappear as well?
No. Those jobs, and they will be top academic women. They will be world-renowned women, you know, in their fields of expertise.
Are you not concerned, though, Minister, that however good the motives may be, and you've explained how there's a dearth of women at the highest level, but that somehow there will be a stigma attaching to these jobs because they're not seen as inviting competition from all quarters, just from one half of the academic society?
Listen, it's not fair what's going on. Women aren't getting to the interviews.
But
they're
the
not
thing
getting
then to
CVs.
Do is to change the procedures, the recruitment procedures.
That's exactly what I'm doing, Sean. And I want to make sure now that women are able to secure these jobs by being the right person and not the wrong gender.
But that's
go
a bit like
the
putting
jobs.
The ball in the penalty spot and saying no goalkeeper allowed to stand in front of the kicker.
Well, I know you're giving me that example, but no, this is really serious. And I have spoken to countless number of academics, men and women, and we know that that is happening in the system. And I can assure you that the Irish University Association group and their own Technological Higher Education Association, they have come out and backed me this morning.
Minister Mary Mitchell O'Connor. Dr. Micheline Sheehy Skeffington knows all about discrimination. She won an equality tribunal case against NUI Galway 4 years ago, and she gave her reaction to Christopher McKevitt on the News at One.
I welcome the minister's initiative, and I welcome the fact she's proactive and dedicated to redressing the gender imbalance, and that there's an active task force. I've mixed feelings about this particular one. When I took my case, which was in 2009, it took a while to win it. It was quite obvious that women were not even getting through to senior lecturer level, and therefore now there's a bottleneck where women couldn't apply for professorship until they were at senior lecturer level. But I would hope that these posts would perhaps be temporary, because if they're permanent posts, it kind of looks like women are being put in a glass case, that they're not able to make it on their own. You know, there's always that sort of thinking about it.
On the surface, it looks like, well, why do women in this day and age need, if you like, that sort of quote unquote special treatment? But your case highlighted the very fact that they do.
Yeah, they do. It's just, as I say, I think gender quotas are a temporary measure until we get equality. You know, I mean, I don't want to have to wait 20 or 30 years to find that, you know, maybe we've just about got equality at professorship level. You know, I think there is a need for quotas. There may be other ways of doing it. So, I've mixed feelings about that, but I do welcome it.
From the News at One with Christopher McKevitt. On Thursday, news came through on Liveline that the king of cabaret, showband singer and musician Sonny Knowles, had died after a career spanning over 60 years. He was 86, a great trooper and entertainer who was performing up to a few years ago. And over on Liveline, the stars lined up to pay tribute. Red Hurley, Shay Healy, Sil Fox, Pat Egan and RTE's Ronan Collins. Everybody, it seems, just loved him.
An absolute gentleman, you're so right. He seemed to be in shock at his success at times and that people would want him, and he had so many successful albums. He could, as you say, he was appearing up to 2 or 3 years ago and still packing the crowds.
He was very self-deprecating. He always said that he had the kind of voice that made everybody else want to cough. That's how he describes his voice, because of the huskiness that he had in it. But what a way he had with a song, and what a knowledge he had of songs and the appropriate key to sing them in. And he could string 100 songs together and just keep going, and everyone would be a winner, and everybody in the audience would sing along and be part and parcel of a Sonny performance. And I think the reason that he was amazed by it was he never tried to analyze it. He said, look, I just get up and sing songs that people know, and God, did they love them. They loved them. It was entertainment, and he was a master.
I'm looking, Ronan, at something that was in the Sunday Indo in 2013. You know, Sonny, you asked your favourite things, your 10 questions. Favourite, what characteristic in yourself do you like the most and least, Sonny Knowles? And Sonny replies, maybe my nerve and my hard neck. Here's Roses of Picardy.
Roses are shining in Picardy. In the hush of the silver dew, roses are blooming in Picardy, but there's never a rose like you.
Ronan Collins with Joe Duffy, remembering the glorious talent of Sonny Knowles. Another legendary musician departed the scene early yesterday morning. Alec Finn, who with Frankie Gavin was the core sound of Daydannan, the supergroup of the 80s. But apart from Daydannan, Alec was also a brilliant artist, a composer, a producer, and a highly influential bouzouki player, as his friend, broadcaster and filmmaker Philip King told Áine Lawler.
A very difficult year for Irish traditional music. Some of the great people who have made contributions to Irish music, unique voices, voices like Tommy Peoples, voices like Liam O'Flynn, voices like Micheál O'Sullivan, have been joined today by Alec Finn, one of the great original voices of Irish traditional music, a unique man in every way. He's left an indelible thumbprint on the sonic landscape of Irish music. His Greek bouzouki with the three sets of strings played in an absolutely unique and individual way by Alec was the foundation stone, along with Frankie Gavin, of the Daydannan sound, which was so musical and so really, really beautiful. He was a blues man. He shared a flat for a while in Dublin with Phil Lynott. He moved west. He lived in Oranmore Castle. He loved hawks, and he had always a hawk by his side. He was a brilliant artist and a unique man in every way, I would think.
Thank you.
the Sally Gardens, played there by Alec Finn from his solo album The Blue Shamrock, which I heard on the Ronan Collins show yesterday. And of course, our hearts go out to Alex's wife, Leo, and their children, Heather and Cian. Suvna Shiri, though. A film on the life and work of Dr. Andrew Rinn got its world premiere last night at the Cork Film Festival. He's best known as the vasectomy doctor and was a leading campaigner for the liberalisation of birth control in this country back in the day. He was Sean O'Rourke's guest yesterday.
I suppose one of the more controversial, not to say memorable, moments in your life, I think it was on the 12th of July 1990, a man came into the surgery looking for you.
He did. He had thought about this for 8 years. 8 years previous to that, he had had a vasectomy done by me. His wife left him, I think, and she became pregnant by somebody else. He had some pain after his vasectomy as well, and he really had it in for me. I didn't know about this, of course, until he came bursting into the surgery with the gun up to his shoulder. He took a crack at me. I was very, very lucky that I wasn't killed at the time.
He took aim at you initially, and this is one of the interesting things, the many interesting things about the short film. He initially pointed the gun
right between my eyes. I could look down the barrel of the gun. And he was also wearing gloves, big, thick woolen gloves, which made the whole thing even more scary, because you shouldn't wear gloves when you're shooting because you can't feel the pressure on the trigger. So, I mean, I was awake a small idea that nothing worse happened to me than I ended up with a bullet in my right hip. It could have gone so easily the other way.
He just pointed down.
Yes, then he dropped the gun and he was pointing at my genitalia, I suppose, which he mercifully missed.
He had an idea of sort of
where there might be
an eye for an eye or a variation of that. Yeah,
that's what it was. Yeah.
So what happened then?
I got out of the room. The man I was doing a vasectomy on escaped as well. He got out first, and I pushed him aside and ran down the corridor. And as I was running down the corridor, he had another crack at me. Then outside, the man who I was going to do a vasectomy on gave the gunman a cigarette and quietened him down a little bit. And then the gunman saw me, and he had another crack at me. And I was standing beside the Leylandi bush, and I could see the leaves of the Leylandi just leaving right beside my head. And then I turned and ran, and he had another crack at me. So this was...
What was the weapon?
A rifle, a 2.2 rifle.
Terrifying. Dr. Andrew Rinn heard on the Today Show yesterday. Belfast poet Michael Longley and his wife, the critic Edna Longley, have been visiting West Mayo since 1970, holidaying in a cottage with her family in the beautiful townland of Carrigskeewaun. It's a place which has inspired so many of Michael Longley's poems. He was Olivia O'Leary's guest on the poetry programme last Sunday.
The cottage belongs to a very great ornithologist called David Cabot, perhaps Ireland's greatest ornithologist. He allows us to stay there when he's not in residence. And we've been going there since 1970. And we brought each of our three children there. And now they bring their children, our grandchildren. And this is a poem about our first grandchild, who's called Ben. And he came as a babe in arms. And the little river nearby, the Owen Adonon, beautiful name, the Owen Adonon was in spate. The poem is about his first visit, and I've called it The Leveret. This is your first night in Carrigskeewaun. The Owen Adonon is so full of rain, you arrived in Paddy Morrison's tractor, a bumpy approach in your father's arms, to the cottage where, all of 1 year ago, you were conceived, a fire seed in the hearth. Did you hear the wind in the fluffy chimney? Do you hear the wind tonight, and the rain, and a shorebird calling from the mussel reefs? Tomorrow I'll introduce you to the sea, little hoplite. Have you been missing it? I'll park your chariot by the otter's rock and carry you over seaweed to the sea. There's a tufted duck on David's lake with her suit full of hatchlings, pom-poms a day old and already learning to dive. We may meet the stoat near the erratic boulder, a shrew in his mouth, or the merlin meadow pipit hunting. But don't be afraid. The leveret breakfasts under the fuchsia every morning, and we shall be watching. I have picked wild flowers for you, scabious and centaury, in a jam jar of water that will bend and magnify the daylight. This is your first night in Corrigskeewaun.
Beautiful. Michael Longley, one of our finest poets. And you can hear the second part of that interview tomorrow night on the Poetry Programme, 7:30, here on RT Radio 1. Forget about guitarists like Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton. If you were a rocker in the Ireland of the 70s, Rory Gallagher was the main man. And his tragic death at the age of 47 ensured his instant canonisation. Julian Vignole's new biography, Rory Gallagher, the man behind the guitar, takes a forensic view of his life and his legacy.
I suppose, to borrow the phrase of Eamon Dunphy back in the day, you went at this not so much as a journalist, but you were a fan with a typewriter maybe as well.
Yes. You do the book because you're a fan, but you cannot write a decent book unless you defan yourself. You have to kind of put the fan aside and try and find the reality behind the legend, if you like.
Right. And what drew you to him?
It was the first edition of Hot Press and we went down to Macroom to sell it. And I'd never seen, or I didn't know who he was, but I'd never seen him before. And this guy bounds onto the stage and I just became a fan that instant. It was a combination of his mastery of the guitar, his singing, his energy and what he gave. Like, it was just, it's in a way it's hard to describe.
He took to the guitar at a very early stage in life, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. I think Rory Gallagher's story is like, it's a fairy tale that unfortunately becomes a tragedy at the end. But the fairy tale aspect of this kid in Derry, who's 6 or 7, tries to get a skiffle band growing on the street, is obsessed with the idea of a guitar, and he gets this 4-stringed Elvis type thing on mail order catalogue, and then there's great folk memory of all that period. Then suddenly, you know, he's winning a competition in the Examiner when he's 12, and the next thing is he gets this Stratocaster. He sees Buddy Holly playing. This is the guitar I want. It's going to cost a fortune. My mother can pay it in installments, and he brings it to bed age 15.
The guitar was obviously a big thing in his life, and by all accounts in your book, the Christian Brothers in the North Mon weren't too impressed.
No. There's a great story that Theo Dorgan, poet, tells of a certain brother he recalls when Rory was quite famous and he was on the cover of Melody Maker. The brother says, "Ah, poor Rory, we didn't hit him hard enough." But it's interesting. I think the fascinating thing about Gallagher is that it didn't dim his faith. That experience with the brothers, of course, I mean, the lay teachers were used corporal punishment as well, and he remained a practicing Catholic the whole of his life.
Really,
and it came into his songs. He was also highly superstitious. He also developed, interestingly, an attachment to Oireachtas Mass. And in fact, when Rory died, there was a memorial for him in November in the London Oratory, and it was the first time a language other than Greek or Latin had been sung in the oratory, because the choir sang Ecris an Chiel.
Julian Vignoles with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Novelist Anne Enright is a great woman for the firsts. The Booker Prize winner was Ireland's first laureate for fiction. She's now added another first to her CV. She's recently been appointed Ireland's first professor of fiction in UCD. She says she loves the students and her role is to teach the craft of writing, to make writing better. When she spoke with Miriam O'Callaghan, she recalled the time when she got a place on the prestigious creative writing course at the University of East Anglia with tutors like Angela Carter and Malcolm Bradbury.
I arrived into the MA in creative writing in UEA with a big sense of the meanness of me, the wonderful meanness of me, and the, you know, and was surprised, or I like to surprise students with the idea that actually it's about the page as much as it is about them. It's what you do rather than what you are, what you make.
Can everyone write?
Can everyone write? Write what?
Can everyone write a good novel?
A good novel.
Good fiction.
I have to say, there are a very few people in Ireland who don't want to. I mean, there are three of them at least, and they're in a pub, been miserable. No, there are at least three Irish people who don't want to write a novel. And Ireland is distinctive for that, because in Germany, people would look at you really bow-ways if you said, well, that's the thing that people want or need to do. So it is a kind of cultural disease, really, that we have to...
It's kind of a nice disease, though, is it?
It is. It's a fantastic, fantastic one. Yeah. Can everyone do it? Yes, everyone can do it. Can they do it well? You know, that's what creative writing courses are there to do, to help you to do it better. That question, Miriam, is about, is everybody wonderful? And yes, the answer is yes, everybody is wonderful. Is everyone extraordinary? Yes, everyone is extraordinary, especially when they dream. Can everyone produce an amazing 80,000 words? Well, they'd have to put the time in.
But I think I could sit down for the next 100 years and never write The Green Road to the Gathering. Like, in other words, some people have surely a far greater talent at writing than others.
And talent is really nothing in the long run. It's all about tenacity, you know.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I see very talented people disappear and I see very untalented people just get better with time and really start producing good work.
That's very interesting. Then, in other words, you can have the talent and maybe not be tenacious enough and therefore not produce the goods.
Well, you can
goods.
Produce a nice lyric poem because it's only, you know, 100 words long. But if you're going to write 60, 70, 80,000 words, then that means going back day after day.
Novelist Anne Enright heard on Sunday with Miriam. Over on the live line on Tuesday, Joe got a call from Margaret Geeran. Her brother John suffers from aggressive motor neuron disease. He can't speak anymore, and he desperately wanted to reconnect with his old friend from his student days, John Moran, whom he hadn't seen for almost 50 years. A tall order, you might think.
We have tried looking for this friend a number of times, but on Sunday, when I was in with him at my brother, we were there the weekend, and I spoke about his friend John, which we know him as
John Moran. Yeah, I'm
getting, John Moran from Drogheda, County Loud.
Okay.
My brother actually wrote John Moran, Drogheda, County Loud, and he said, "Find, find, find." Okay. So I said, "Okay, the person I'm going to contact is Geography. He may do this miracle for us."
Now, as you know, John Moran's a very common name in Ireland. And we have a John Moran from Drogheda on the line, I'm told. John, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Are you the John Moran? Are you Big John?
I am, yeah.
Are you?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I can't believe it. Oh, my God. Oh, God. I can't believe it. My brother John Gavin's friend.
I am, yes, yes, yes.
You bought me my first pair of Wranglers. Oh, my God.
This is a very, very emotional thing after 48 years. No, this morning when your people phoned me and she said, you're John Moran, and she mentioned John Geeran. And I said, yes, I remember him, because, strange enough, I tried to make contact. I tried to make inquiries.
You tried to find him?
I did about 25 years ago.
And he's been trying to find you.
Nothing came of it. So it wasn't a case as if I got him. Like, I kind of always remembered there,
And you knew each other in Leicester, John?
We did. We met in Charles King College, yes.
And were you born in Leicester?
No, I was born here in Junestown in County Meath. My family got back to 1751 here in Drogheda, so.
And what, you were studying in...
I was over there,
Okay. And you were training to be, what, electrical
engineer? Engineering I was, yeah.
Okay, and you bonded, obviously, very quickly.
We did. We'd sit on the side of the street at the wall and have a chat at night. And then I'd wally off home, and that's the way it was,
So, all's well that ends well, from Liveline with Joe Duffy on Tuesday. Mary-Kate Slattery is a third-year law student at Trinity College in Dublin and training to become an Olympic boxer. She's also organising the inaugural Millennial Ball of the Year to raise funds for Down Syndrome Ireland. And if that wasn't enough to mark her out as a dynamic young woman, she also told Ryan Tuberty of her struggle to overcome anorexia nervosa.
As we spoke to Ivana Lynch on the programme yesterday, and she spoke so eloquently about an eating disorder and that time in her life. When you were nine... Yes. You were diagnosed with what?
With anorexia nervosa.
That to me sounds so young. Can you tell me how that happens at such a young age?
I was very young, and at that point I didn't even know what it was. So I had no idea what anorexia was. I just knew that it was a person in my head telling me not to eat. And at that point it was a person who I really loved and I wanted to cooperate with. And the hardest part was breaking down, you know, as I saw it, I was married to this person in my head and the two of us were very much on a mission to lose weight, to scare people, to, you know, drive myself into this frenzy of starvation and self-loathing.
It's a voice.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's a very live, real voice.
It is, yeah. It's part of your brain and it's just somebody that, you know, disconnecting it. So it's seeing it as somebody else and it's not me. I actually named it. I named my anorexia at the time, and lots of people who suffer with anorexia or bulimia or eating disorders or even addictions will decide to
name
that voice.
Can I ask what you named it?
Eunice.
Eunice, yeah. Like it's a person.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were 9 at this point.
I was.
Like, it's like an imaginary friend.
Yes, absolutely. And that's how it was explained to me because I was so young. It was just nothing I could understand.
And when did she show up?
She showed up in 2006. There was a bereavement in the family that I suffered with. And I think it was a...
You connect the two?
I do. I connect a few things. I definitely don't, you know, attribute it mainly to that. But I think that was a massive contributing factor. At that end, I was always a very driven and very motivated, so obsessive compulsive. And I still am. But now I managed to channel that into things that I love.
That
and
you love doing.
Good energy, rather than something that will completely destroy me and...
And possibly kill you.
Absolutely.
Between the age of 9 and 10, and you had Eunice showing up.
Yes.
When in a typical day would she show up?
Oh, she'd be there constantly. Yeah, it was something that was dominated my life for 4 years. Never left.
So give me an example of sitting down for breakfast or having lunch or getting hungry or whatever and that voice showing up.
So when I think about it, I think that the food was almost a side effect of what was actually going on. I was trying to improve myself, and the way that I was trying to improve myself was through losing weight. I was obsessed with constantly improving, constantly seeing myself as the better Mary Kate, and through that, I became obsessed with dieting and I was addicted to it.
And what was Eunice saying to you?
She was saying, you're not good enough. You are not good enough unless you know, I'd start off with, you know, finishing half my dinner, then it would be a quarter of my dinner, then I'd be leaving little bits, and then it would become more and more and more, and it would just grow back out.
And is she saying, eat less?
Eat less, always.
Make yourself look better by being skinnier.
Exactly. Be more beautiful version. And, you know, I definitely didn't like myself at that point. I actually hated myself at that point.
Do you know why?
I don't. Well, I know that I don't anymore. So that's the main thing. But at the time, I just definitely had no confidence.
From the Ryan Tubridy Show on Tuesday. Well, it's going to be some showdown this evening in Lansdowne Road between the number 2 and the number 1 ranked teams in the world as Ireland hosts the All Blacks.
New Zealand versus Ireland. Played 30, won 28, lost 1. The greatest team in the history of rugby union comes to the Aviva Stadium on Saturday night, and logic says they can't be beaten. But logic has never stopped the Irish rugby pundits from massively overstating Ireland's chances of winning unwinnable matches. As you know, I don't like talking about the spear tackle, but then Guinness reversed a truck of cash onto my lawn.
Yeah!
Don't forget to drink Guinness and watch Amy's Finding Joy, because, like, no one else is.
As Minister for Sport, I'm delighted to declare this the clash of the colonies. ERA versus New Zealand on a historic weekend which will resonate throughout the empire. Huzzah!
Eddie O'Sullivan.
The referee's going to be Ireland's biggest problem. Wayne Barnes is a bit whistle-happy, like one of Snow White's 7 horsemen of the apocalypse. But if Ireland can hit the barn door after the horse has bolted, then we have a great chance of finishing the evening on top of a hill of beans.
George Hook.
It's going to be an intense night of number 1 versus number 2. And that hasn't happened since the lovely Ingrid served up that chicken vindaloo last year.
And Michael Corcoran.
Garnet, on our best ring rolls. Send our names out loud and cut out your tongue and never make him again, because this is history, this is geography, this is maths and science. It's going to be Ireland's first victory of the All Blacks on home soil since the famous Munster defeated them in 78. Nothing can go wrong. Oh, I have to change my trousers.
Oliver Callan and his crew from Callan's Kicks last night. But I leave you now with a song from the Streetlights Collective, which I heard on the Ryan Tubridy Show yesterday. The collective features artists like Bono, Villagers, Colum McInamara, Snow Patrol, Roshino, Loa, the High Hopes Choir, and they've come together to record the Simon and Garfunkel classic Homeward Bound to raise funds for the homeless in the run-up to Christmas. It's gorgeous and it's bound to be number one. Gurumhagwa Vasur Golúder, Tasulam Gurwanchiv, Saltasaglar, Agus Gameshivlam, Taka Anamakena, Antachtan Chahugin, Gajishin, Gajeshab Slan.
Sitting at the railway station, got a ticket for my destination.